Chapter 14. Glory to the Rooster. His nerves couldn't take it, as they say, and Rimsky did not wait for the police report to be finished and fled to his office. He now sat at his desk and stared at the magical 10-ruble bills lying before him with swollen eyes. The financial director's mind was severely disturbed. A steady hum came from the outside. Streams of people poured out of the variety and onto the street. The financial director's extremely sensitive ears suddenly picked up the distinctive trill of a police whistle. By its very nature, the sound did not bode well. And when it came again, aided by a longer and more forceful second, and joined by clearly audible guffawing and even some whooping, the financial director immediately deduced that something wicked and scandalous had taken place outside on the street, and that this event, as much as one would like to shrug it off, was very closely connected to the repulsive séance orchestrated by the black magician and his assistants. The perceptive financial director was not the least bit mistaken. No sooner did he glance through the window facing out on Sadovaya than his face twisted and he hissed rather than whispered, "I knew it." In the bright glare of powerful streetlights, he saw a lady wearing only a chemise and violet underwear on the pavement below. There was a hat on her head, however, and an umbrella in her hands. The lady was in a state of utter confusion, crouching one moment and making to run off somewhere the next. An excited crowd encircled her, producing the very guffawing that sent chills down the financial director's spine. Some gentleman darted round the lady, trying to tear off his summer coat, but too agitated to free his arm, which was stuck in one of the sleeves. Shouts and roaring laughter came from another spot, more specifically by the left entrance, and turning his head, Grigory Danilovich beheld a second lady, this one in pink undergarments. She had leapt off the road and onto the pavement, aiming to hide in a doorway, but the emerging people blocked her path. Deceived by the vile fagot's store, the poor victim of her own frivolity and love of garments dreamt of but one thing, to be swallowed up by the earth. A policeman headed for the unfortunate woman, piercing the air with his whistle, and several happy young men in caps hurried after him. They turned out to be the source of the guffawing and whooping. A thin cabbie with a moustache flew up to the first undressed woman and briskly reined in his bony, broken horse. The moustached face bore a happy grin. Rimsky hit his head with his fist, spat, and jumped away from the window. He sat at his desk for a while, listening to the sounds from the street. The whistling from different directions reached its high point and then began to fade. To Rimsky's surprise, the scandal was liquidated with unusual speed. It was time for action, and he would have to drink the bitter cup of responsibility. The phones had been fixed during the third segment, and he needed to call, report what had happened, ask for help, lie, dump everything on Likhodiev, exonerate himself, and so on. Bah! Damn it to hell! Twice the upset director laid his hand upon the receiver, and twice he took it off. And suddenly, in the dead silence of the office, the phone itself exploded in sound right in the financial director's face, and he flinched and went cold. "My nerves are seriously upset, though," he thought as he picked up the receiver. He drew back from it the same instant and grew whiter than paper. A quiet and at the same time sneaky and lewd female voice whispered from the receiver, "Don't call anyone, Rimsky, or else." The receiver fell silent at once. Feeling goosebumps on his back, the financial director put down the receiver and glanced at the window behind him for some reason. Through the sparse branches of the maple, lightly coated in green, he saw the moon racing through a transparent cloud. His eyes chained to the branches, Rimsky stared. And the more he stared, the stronger and stronger grew the fear that gripped him. Making an effort, the financial director turned away from the moonlit window and rose. All telephone calls were now completely out of the question, and the financial director thought of only one thing: how to leave the theatre as soon as possible. He listened. The theatre was silent. Rimsky realised that he had been alone on the second floor for some time, and an insurmountable, childlike fear took hold of him at this thought. The idea of crossing the empty hallways alone and descending the stairs made him shudder. He feverishly grabbed the hypnotist's tens off the desk, put them in his briefcase, and coughed to give himself a little courage. The cough came out hoarse and weak. And then he felt a sort of putrid dampness drift in from under the office door. Shivers ran down the financial director's spine. On top of that, the clock suddenly began to strike midnight. Even the chimes caused the financial director to shake. But his heart truly sank when he heard the English key turning quietly in the lock. Digging into his briefcase with cold, clammy hands, the financial director felt that if the rustling in the keyhole were to last even a little longer, he would cave in and let out a piercing scream. The door finally yielded to someone's efforts and opened. Varyonika stepped noiselessly into the office. Rimsky sat down in the chair right where he stood, for his legs buckled underneath him. Gathering enough air in his lungs, he smiled a fawning sort of smile and said quietly, "God, how you frightened me!" True, the sudden arrival could have frightened anyone, and nonetheless it was also a source of great joy. At least one end in this tangled case had turned up. "Well, speak already! Well, well!" Rimsky said hoarsely, grasping at that end. "What does it all mean?" "Forgive me, please," the visitor said in a hollow voice, closing the door. "I thought you'd already left." And, without taking off his cap, Varyonika went to a chair and sat on the opposite side of the table. There was something a little strange in Varyonika's response, and it pricked instantly at the financial director, whose sensitivity could rival that of the world's best seismographs. How could this be? Why would Varyonika go to the financial director's office if he did not expect to find him there? He had an office of his own. This was the first problem, and here was the second. No matter what entrance Varyonika used to get in, he invariably had to have run into one of the night watchmen, who had all been told that Grigory Danilovich would stay late in his office. But the financial director did not puzzle at this oddity for long. He had other things to worry about. "Why didn't you call? What's the meaning of all that nonsense with Yalta?" "Well, it's just like I said," the manager replied, smacking his lips as if he had a toothache. "They found him in the tavern at Pushkino."
"What do you mean, in Pushkino? Just outside Moscow? What about the telegrams from Yalta?"
"The hell they were. He got Pushkino's telegrapher drunk, and they both started messing around, sending telegrams marked Yalta, among other things."
"Yeah, aha. Well, okay.
Okay," Rimsky practically sang, his eyes lit up with little yellow flames. A festive picture of Stiopa's disgraceful dismissal from work came together in his head.
Freedom! Long-awaited freedom for the financial director from misery in the person of Likhodiev.
Or perhaps Stefan Bogdanovich would lose more than his job.
"Details," Rimsky said, tapping a paperweight on his desk.
And so Varyonika began to narrate the details. As soon as he got to where the financial director had sent him, he was received at once and most carefully listened to. No one believed for a minute that Stiopa could be in Yalta. Everyone immediately agreed with Varyonika's theory that Likhodiev was in Pushkino's Yalta.
"Where is he now?" interrupted the excited financial director.
"Where else?" the manager replied with a crooked grin. "In the drunk tank, of course."
"Well, well. Oh, thank you."
Meanwhile, Varyonika went on with his story. And the further he got, the more vivid became the lengthy chain of Likhodiev's subsequent indecencies and atrocities. As it unfolded before the financial director, each new link was worse than the last. How about the drunken dance with the telegrapher on the front lawn of Pushkino's telegraph to the tune of some errant harmonica? The pursuit of some ladies who were screaming in terror? The attempt to beat up the bartender at the Yalta itself? The scattering of scallions on the floor of the selfsame Yalta? The smashing of 8 bottles of dry white Idanil? The breaking of a taxi's meter when the driver would not let Stiopa in the cab? The threats of arrest made against citizens who attempted to put a stop to Stiopa's rampage? In other words, a nightmare. Stiopa was well known in Moscow's theatrical circles, and everyone knew that the man was no joy to deal with. But still, the manager's tale seemed a little over the top, even for Stiopa. Yes, a little over the top. Perhaps even a lot. Rimsky's piercing eyes cut into the manager's face from across the table, and the more Valyonika spoke, the grimmer those eyes became. The more lifelike and colourful the despicable details tacked on by the manager, the less the financial director believed them. When Varyonika informed him that Stiopa had lost it to the point of resisting those sent to return him to Moscow, the financial director firmly knew that all that the midnight visitor had told him was, all of it, lies. Lies from the first word to the last. Varyonika never went to Pushkino, nor did Stiopa himself. There was no drunken telegrapher, no broken window in the tavern. No one bound Stiopa with ropes. None of it happened. As soon as the financial director became firmly convinced that the manager was lying, fear began to crawl along his body from the feet up. And for the second time, he felt a putrid, malarial dampness creeping along the floor. Without taking his eyes off the manager, who contorted in his chair, always trying to stay in the blue shade of the desk lamp, awkwardly hiding from the apparently unpleasant light behind a newspaper, the financial director thought of only what it could all mean. Why would the all-too-late returned manager lie to him so brazenly in this empty and silent building? And the cognizance of danger, unknown but ominous, began to gnaw at the financial director's soul. Pretending not to notice the manager's evasions and tricks with the newspaper, the financial director stared at Varyonika's face, barely listening to whatever the man was spinning. There was something far more bizarre than the slanderous and, for reasons unknown, fictitious tale of Pushkino escapades, and that something was the change in the manager's appearance and behaviour. No matter how much the latter pulled the duckbill visor of his cap over his eyes to cast a shadow on his face, no matter how he twisted the newspaper sheet, the financial director managed to see a gigantic bruise on the right side of his face near the nose. Besides that, the usually full-blooded manager was now covered in a sickly, chalky pallor. And despite the hot, stuffy night, an old striped scarf was twisted round his neck for some reason. Factoring in the disgusting habit of sucking and smacking acquired by the manager during his absence, his significantly altered voice, now hollow and coarse, and the shiftiness and trepidation in his eyes, one could easily say that Ivan Savelyevich Varyonika had become completely unrecognizable. Something else drove the financial director to burn in agitation, but what it was, he could not decipher. No matter how much he strained his inflamed mind, no matter how hard he peered at Varyonika, he could only ascertain that there was something unbelievable, unnatural, in the union of the manager with the familiar chair. "So they got the best of him, finally loaded him into the car," Varyonika droned, peeking out from behind the newspaper sheet and covering the bruise with the palm of his hand. Rimsky,
extended his hands suddenly, his fingers playing along the tabletop, and, as if accidentally, pressed the button of the electric bell with his palm. He froze stiff. The sharp noise would undoubtedly have been heard throughout the empty building. But the noise did not follow, and the button sank lifelessly into the plane of the desktop. The button was dead, the bell broken. The financial director's guile did not escape Florionica, who twitched and asked, with an unmistakably hateful fire in his eyes, "What are you ringing for?"
"Just a reflex,"
the financial director replied dully, yanking back his hand, and asked unsteadily in turn,
"What's that on your face?"
"Car skidded, hit myself on the door handle," Varionika replied, averting his eyes. "He's lying," the financial director exclaimed mentally, and then his eyes grew round and absolutely mad as he stared at the back of the chair. Behind the chair on the floor lay two overlapping shadows, one thicker and darker, the other faded and grey. The shadows cast by the chair's back and sharp legs showed clearly on the floor, but the shadow of Varionika's head was missing above the back, just as the shadows from the manager's legs were not among those of the chair's legs.
"He is not casting a shadow," Rimsky cried desperately in his own head. He began to shake.
Varionika looked back furtively, following Rimsky's crazed glance to beyond the chair's back, and realized that he had been exposed. He rose from the chair, the financial director did the same, and stepped back from the table, clutching his briefcase. "You guessed it, you bastard. Always were the clever one," Varionika said, sneering maliciously right in the financial director's face. Suddenly, he jumped from the chair to the door and quickly pushed down the latch of the English lock. The financial director looked round in desperation, retreated towards the window facing the garden, and in that moon-flooded window, he saw the face of a naked girl pressed against the glass, her bare arm reaching through the vent, trying to open the bottom latch. The top one was already open. It seemed to Rimsky that the light from his desk lamp was fading, and the desk itself tilting. An icy wave washed over him, but fortunately he overcame himself and remained on his feet. The remainder of his strength went into a whisper, not a scream. "Help!" Valionica hopped around by the door he was guarding, remaining in the air for long periods of time. He kept waving at Rimsky with crooked fingers, hissing and smacking and winking at the girl in the window. She hurried, stuck her head of red hair through the vent, extended her arm as far as she could, and began to claw at the bottom latch with her fingernails, shaking the window frame. Her arm began to stretch as if made of rubber, and turned putrid green. Finally, the dead woman's green fingers clasped the knob of the latch, turned it, and the frame began to open. Rimsky cried out weakly, leaned against the wall, and thrust out his briefcase like a shield. He understood that his end had come. The frame swung wide open, but instead of the fresh night air and the aroma of lindens, a crypt-like stench tore into the room. The dead woman stepped onto the windowsill. Rimsky clearly saw the spots of decay on her chest. And then a joyous, unexpected crowing of a rooster came from the garden, from the low structure behind the shooting gallery, where the various birds used in performances were kept. The raucous-trained rooster trumpeted his announcement that dawn was rolling into Moscow from the east. Savage fury distorted the girl's face, and she let out a hoarse curse, while Varionika squealed by the door and tumbled from the air onto the floor. The rooster's cry came again, the girl clacked her teeth, and her red hair stood on end. At the rooster's third cry, she turned and flew out.
following her, leaping and extending horizontally in the air so that he resembled a flying Cupid, Varyonika floated slowly over the desk and out the window. White as snow, without a single remaining black hair, the old man, who had recently been Rimsky, ran to the door, undid the latch, opened the door, and dashed down the dark corridor. At the turn to the staircase, moaning in fear, he fumbled for the switch, and the staircase lit up. On the stairs, the trembling, shaking old man fell because he imagined that Varyonika had softly pounced on him from above. Running down, Rimsky saw the night watchman, who had fallen asleep on his chair by the box office in the vestibule. Rimsky stole past him on tiptoes and slipped out the main entrance. Out on the street, he felt somewhat better. He collected himself enough that, grasping his head, he managed to recall that he had left his hat in the office. Needless to say, he did not return for it. Instead, gasping for air, he ran across the broad street towards a dim red light hovering on the corner by the movie theatre. In another moment, he was next to it. No one had managed to grab the taxi. "To the Leningrad Express with a good tip," the old man said, panting and clutching his heart. "I'm going to the garage," the driver answered hatefully and turned away. Then Rimsky opened his briefcase, extracted 50 rubles, and handed them to the driver through the open window. Several moments later, the clattering car was flying down the Sadovaya Ring Road like a hurricane. The passenger was tossed around on the back seat, and in the broken piece of mirror hanging before the driver, Rimsky could see the driver's happy eyes alternate with his own crazed ones. Jumping out of the car in front of the train station, Rimsky shouted at the first man he saw in a white apron with a badge. "First class, single, I'll pay you 30. Crumpling the tens, he took them out of his briefcase. "No first, I'll take second. Nil second, give me the hard bench." Glancing back at the lit clock, the man with the badge tore the tens from Rimsky's hands. 5 minutes later, the express disappeared from underneath the glass dome of the train station and vanished entirely in the darkness. Rimsky vanished with it.